Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Yesterday marked the 25th anniversary of the very first UFC event in Denver, Colorado. Delighted to say we're joined on the line now by co-creator Mr. Art Davey and UFC Hall of Famer this year in 2018. Art, first of all, absolutely great to have you on Off the Ball. How are you, my friends?
Doing very well, Niall. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Brilliant stuff, Art. I really want to get a, you know, give our listeners a sense of what it was like back in 1993. The whole concept, how you got around to coming up with this.
Well, you know, for me, it goes back to an experience I had in 1965. I was 18 years old. I was taking boxing lessons. I was getting ready to go in the Golden Gloves. And I wound up getting into a sparring match with a wrestler. To make a long story short, about 20 seconds later, I was on the ground. He was on top of me, and I was lost. So I never forgot that. That made an enormous impression on me. Now, a few years later, I'm in the Marine Corps, and every grunt in the Marines had an opinion about boxing versus wrestling versus the martial arts. The big debate was always, could Bruce Lee have beaten Muhammad Ali? Everybody had an opinion. And, you know, most of those mixed matches never really took off. Because everybody would get in an argument about the rules and the money. You know, how much do I get? How much does the other guy get? And can I wear a gi? Can we wear gloves? Is it in the ring? Is it on the beach? Where do we do it? So this idea stayed in my mind. And years later, I'm in advertising. And at one point, one of our clients wanted some new ideas. And one of the ideas they came up with was a tournament called the World's Best Fighter. And the client looked at it and said, well, it's interesting, it's exciting, but it seems uber violent. So the bottom line is I wound up with a whole file folder full of contacts and information. And part of that was an article in the Playboy magazine in September of 1988 or 89, and it was about the Gracie family.
Yeah.
The article was titled Bad, B-A-D. So that's how I eventually got in contact with the Gracies.
But, you know, then putting it together, obviously the Gracies, you know, the founder of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and ultimately we had Royce Gracie win the tournament. What was your thought process in actually getting the fighters together? Because I know you're a guy who loves your entertainment. That's very, very important to you. How did you come about getting the different characters and different styles of fighters to compete in this tournament?
Well, you know, we wound up placing ads at the time with our company, WOW Promotions, a company that I had established in Colorado, because I figured out that they were virtually the only state in the United States that had a loophole which permitted bare-knuckle fighting. So we were then running ads in Black Belt Magazine, Inside Karate Magazine, Inside Kung Fu, and I began faxing. In those days with no internet, you sent faxes, and they went out to every martial arts organization that was listed in the back of the magazines, every Taekwondo association, every major gym. I was calling over to Holland to talk to people at the Maguro Gym and the Chakariki Gym in Amsterdam, calling Japan to see if I could get a sumo wrestler, and calling boxing gyms in the United States, Detroit, St. Louis, and Philadelphia, looking for a professional heavyweight boxer. So that's the methodology that we were using to reach out and find fighters. And I wound up selecting 7 out of the 10 fighters that we needed for UFC 1. Horion, of course, produced somebody from the Gracie family, and I wanted Hickson, but he selected Royce. That was partly due to some of the family politics and the fact that he felt that Royce would make an even greater impression on martial arts fans in that he was not a big man and didn't look as fearsome as the family champion, Hickson. Horian also introduced me to Frank Trejo, and Trejo was a promoter of the International Kickboxing Federation. Their super heavyweight champ was Stevie Wonder's bodyguard, a big fellow by the name of Zane Fraser. So there was two fighters that that Horian got, and there was somebody that I had seen compete against Hoyler Gracie in the back of the Gracie Academy, a young man named Jason DeLucia from the Massachusetts area, an Aikido specialist, and he had lost to Hoyler Gracie, but he made an impression on Horian and I, so I picked him as an alternate. So we wound up getting ready with 10 fighters, 8 for the tournament, and 2 alternates for UFC 1. And it finally took place, as you know, on November 12th, 1993.
What were the expectations like in terms of, you know, mix and matching the fighting styles amongst the competitors? What was the atmosphere like backstage at the McNichols Arena in Denver that night?
Well, you know, a lot of people, when I say a lot, Ken Shamrock is an example, was never completely sure until the night of the event that this was a shoot. In promoters' terms, you're familiar with a shoot. Yeah. Is a contest where the contestants are competing equally, and it's not prearranged as far as the outcome in any way. A work is an arrangement whereby one fighter, usually just one, that's all you need, knows what the outcome is to be. He's supposed to lose. And he allows himself to be dominated by his opponent. So here's Ken Shamrock on Wednesday night, November 9th or November 10th, saying to me, is this a work, Art, or is this a shoot? I said, Ken, we've had this discussion. So backstage, there was a sense of expectation. There was a lot of nerves. And, you know, poor Art Jimison on Wednesday night, Wednesday afternoon, he wound up rolling in the gym with Big John McCarthy, who was there as part of the Gracie camp, who at the time was, I believe, a purple belt in jiu-jitsu. And Jimison got spooked by what he experienced with McCarthy. He thought he could hit McCarthy, and when he didn't and ended up on the ground with McCarthy on top of him, he said, "This guy's going to break my arm, isn't he?" Referring to Hoyce, if he got matched with Hoyce. And John said, "Yes." So by Friday morning, he was already telling his agent, attorney Phil Baker, that he wanted to go home, back to St. Louis. He didn't want to fight. So there was that kind of expectation in the dressing area, and there was a big monitor there. And so when that first bout took place between Gerard Gourdeau and Taylor Tooley, the Hawaiian sumo wrestler, you could see that everybody knew that this was not a work. This was the real deal. And it looked like the blood drained from everybody's face, no matter what color they were.
I can imagine so.
Everybody looked nervous. That's the feeling backstage. Yes.
What was your feeling as well? Because you must have been like, this is a blank canvas here, and obviously I have a major investment in this emotionally and otherwise. And had you trepidation that this might kind of be a flop, or were you very confident?
Well, you know, I was still doing the matchups. In those days, of course, I was not only the booker but the matchmaker. And until UFC 2, where we went to a bubble machine to pick the matchups at the press conference, UFC 1, I was still in my hotel room on Wednesday night, the night before the fighters' meeting on Thursday, working out the matchups. I was trying to create the best a scenario that I thought would be the most entertaining. I didn't want to end up with two grapplers in the final. So feeling that the two best grapplers were Hoyce and Ken Shamrock, I made sure that they were in opposite wings, you know, and or they were in the same wing so that they would have to face each other before the final. I didn't want to wound up with Ken in the final facing Hoyce. I felt that that would not be something that the fans would be prepared for. I wanted to see the best grappler, whether it was Hoyce or Shamrock, up against the best kicker puncher. And I felt that that was either, well, I wasn't sure. Was it going to be Fraser? Was it going to be Gourdeau? Or would it be the boxer, Jimerson? So I was nervous myself, You know, we had never done this before. Really, nobody had done this before on live TV. And I can tell you that the night of the event, Horian and I looked at each other. We were both dressed up in our new tuxedos, and we grabbed each other and hugged, because I think we realized we were at the end of a long road that had started virtually a year before, virtually in October of 1992. So here we were a year later, and this thing was finally taking place. I was a little nervous. On the other hand, the people in the truck, the camera crew, the TV people, they were freaking out, because they kept saying to the director, Mark Lucas, is there any chance that the police could show up? Could we be arrested? You know? And Lucas kept having to reassure everybody. And everybody also was asking Lucas the question, is anybody going to die? You know, everybody was nervous. So that's the feeling before the first UFC. Now, you know, a couple of hundred MMA events later, everybody kind of knows what to expect. But that first UFC was like being a test pilot going up into the stratosphere without a parachute.
You talk about a test pilot, and we obviously know the Octagon is infamous with mixed martial arts. But talk to me about how that came about. That story is fascinating to me. We spoke about that before in the past, Art. Tell our listeners how that story came about and how you came about using the Octagon in the UFC.
Well, you know, early on, Horian had some strong feelings based upon his family's experience with Vale Tudo bouts in Brazil, that a boxing ring was not conducive to this type of a freestyle, virtually a mixed match event. He said it's too easy for one of the fighters to end up on the ground and then to slide out of the ring. Suddenly the fight has to be stopped. They have to get the fighter back into the boxing ring. And he says it's a disaster. So he had very strong feelings about that. Now, our TV partner, Semaphore Entertainment Group, one of the first things they said to me when we were in the contract stage of negotiating a joint venture agreement on this deal, they said, well, we're going to do a boxing ring, right? And I said, no, I said, we're not doing a boxing ring. So now we all had to go back to the drawing board. And I had come up with a couple of wild ideas myself. I talk about it in my book about the first UFC, Is This Legal?, that I thought about, you know, a flat circular area that would be bounded by a copper ring, which would be electrified. And then one of the Gracie students, who was the cardiologist, said, have you ever heard the term ventricular fibrillation? I didn't. He said, if anybody who's sweating lands chest down on that ring, he's going to get a heart attack. So the copper ring flat surface Li Tai area based on Chinese wushu events, that was out. We even thought about a moat. I said, you know, we could have a moat. And we could fill it with water and put lemon sharks in it. We'd feed them beforehand so they'd be as tame as catfish or goldfish. And wouldn't that be spectacular? And, you know, when talking to the TV production people at Semaphore, they said, Art, do you have any idea how difficult it's going to be to do that every time we do an event? Because, you know, we did sign a 5-year deal. So there were a couple of wild ideas that really went nowhere, including my plexiglass idea. I thought about a plexiglass bowl Our director, Mark Lucas, and our line producer, Michael Pilot, said, the lights will bounce off that. We won't be able to get any kind of a clear shot. And what about your fighters landing on a hard plexiglass floor or wall? So, quite frankly, the problem got solved when Michael Pilot contacted two set designers, Jason Cussin and Greg Harrison, who had built movie sets and stage sets for a number of their pay-per-view concert events. And those guys were ready and willing to design something, but they needed some guidance. Horian and I wrote a one-page guideline in which we talked about what it needed to be. I recommended 30 feet across. I knew boxing rings were 24 feet. I wanted something that was more like a Lei Tai in China, a 30 feet. And we talked about how much of a cushioned surface, maybe a 2-inch foam rubber pad underneath the canvas, because we had grapplers. And I figured if somebody drops someone on their head in a suplex, we're going to get a broken neck. I knew we need a little more padding. But it couldn't be too thick to slow the kicker punchers down. So with this one-page outline that Horian and I did, We gave it to Michael Pilot in New York, who gave it to Husson and Harrison, and they sat down and came up with four or five different designs. Some of them were pretty spectacular. They had flaming torches at the four corners. They had fake rocks making it look like it was took place in the prehistoric days, the Pleistocene era. There was chain. There was barbed wire on the top of one, you know, on the cage of one, emphasizing that this was, you know, quite different than boxing and wrestling. So they finally came up with a design which we all agreed to, and that's the modern octagon. And Mark Lucas was able to construct his television crew to operate on that perimeter, and he wound up building boxes and painting them black, wooden boxes and painting them black, virtually 2 days before the event, so that the stationary crew with the handheld cameras, we wound up doing seven cameras for that first event, including a Chapman Crane. So that's the story of how the Octagon came about. And the true story is after the first event, Lucas was breaking down the Octagon. Yeah. Michael Pilot was supervising the crew, and they were talking about dumping it. And I said, what do you mean dumping it? It costs $28,000. Well, they said it's a set. We'll build another one for the next event. And I said, no. We pay $28,000, Semaphore and WOW Promotions, for that thing. I said, I have a rental space here in Denver. And I gave Michael Pilot the key. And that's how the Octagon got saved.
Towards the end of your time in the UFC and with the promotion, your relation became a little bit strained with, Bob Merowitz, the original investor and owner, and Campbell McLaren as well. Can you speak just true about your exit from the UFC and how you felt about that and what actually went on in the whole situation with you and Bob Merowitz?
Well, you know, the arrangement between WOW Promotions, the company that Horian and I founded in Denver, the LLC company, limited liability company, and Semaphore Entertainment was always a complicated one. We provided the tournament concept, the fighters, the medical, the transportation. And for the first show, we paid for the purse, which was about $116,000 all total. And starting in the second event, because that was in the book, we were still negotiating the night of the event on the final agreement to sign it, because they couldn't put it on pay-per-view until I did, and then I got Bob Marowitz to agree that they would pay for the purse starting in UFC 2. So we had a five-year deal, and for as long as this was to run, there was a non-compete at the end that if they bought us out or we moved on, that we would be prohibited from getting into this business, the sport combat business, for 2 years. So as we moved on forward and the events started to become more frequent, we were starting to do six of them a year, becoming very successful. By UFC 5, we were doing 300,000 pay-per-view subscribers in North America. Those are numbers that were staggering. Incredible, in those days, because the universe for pay-per-view was even smaller than it is today. So the relationship was one that was, it started out with some difficulties, and with the pressure that we had from politicians and the media, it was always under a great strain. Now, as we got into 1997, we wound up eventually losing pay-per-view. And I had, at that point, my non-compete had expired, because in 1995, seeing the pressure, Niall, I decided that we should sell. And we did. We sold our portion, the 50% that WOW Promotions owned, to our TV partner, Semaphore. I stayed on board for the next 2.5 years as the matchmaker booker. But by 1997, we had lost pay-per-view, and I was looking at starting a new rival promotion. You know, it was like at that point I felt the way parents do when they realize their kid doesn't need them anymore. You thought about having another baby. So that's what I thought about doing. And Bob Myrowitz eventually found out about it. And he said, well, you're that unhappy? I said, well, look, Bob, I said, we've done as much as we can here. I see that, we're starting to, the budget is getting very tight because we lost pay-per-view. I said, you know, my non-compete had expired. And so in January of 1998, we parted company. Mm. It wasn't a happy ending. Yeah. But, you know, at that point, the UFC was under great pressure. and had lost basically the pay-per-view distribution channel that we had had, which was so successful.
How do you feel about mixed martial arts now compared to back in those days? Obviously, you know, there was no rules back, right back in the day. Then it obviously, you know, there was weight classes came in. Yourself and John McCarthy, I know you had a big say in helping out John with the rules setting, unified rules of mixed martial arts. Do you look at mixed martial arts now and go, it's maybe lost something, or are you happy that it has all these rules and regulations in place?
Well, you know, I was the commissioner starting in UFC 6 for the Ultimate Fighting Alliance, and I wrote 5 rule books. My big asset there was John McCarthy and, to a lesser extent, Jeff Blatnick. And by the time of UFC 15, virtually 85% of the rules of the unified rules of MMA that were adopted by New Jersey and Nevada 2001 were already in place. So we knew two things started to change very early on. Number one, we started to add rules starting in UFC 2. And by UFC 15, we had gloves, we had rounds, we had weight classes, we had prohibited strikes. It was a natural evolution in order to keep this thing going. We had to move from spectacle and become more of a sport.
But for you, is that important? Is that what you wanted to see?
Well, you know, I wasn't thrilled about it because my original concept was no rules. You know, that we wanted to keep it pure. But, you know, we were under tremendous pressure. You know, we virtually in Detroit, you know, we literally were facing a judge which prohibited close fist strikes. You know, you're looking in Puerto Rico, we were up against the Ministry of Sport who wanted to ban the event at the last minute. You know, we were under great pressure. We had it sanctioned in New York, and then at the last minute, with pressure from the media and from Mayor Giuliani in New York City, we wound up losing New York sanctioning and having to move the event at the last minute to Dothan, Alabama, UFC 12. So, I mean, the pressure was enormous. The other thing which changed, too, was the fighters started to cross-train starting right after UFC 2 and 3. Kimo Leopoldo was at the Gracie Academy after UFC 3 asking Horion for jiu-jitsu lessons. The fighters started to evolve the sport, and I knew that was inevitable, and I knew that was a natural progression. Well, I wasn't thrilled about having to make the rule changes, quite frankly. And in all fairness, by the time that the Fertittas got involved in 2001, they began or had really started to move the sport more towards submission kickboxing in terms of defining it what it was. So do I miss the old days? Oh, you bet. It was wild and woolly and crazy and great. The guys had a sense, the fighters, that they were something special. They were test pilots, and they partied in a way afterwards that showed you that they loved and respected each other. There wasn't that much money being made by comparison. You know, guys were getting $50,000 to $100,000 to win. Today, the money's a lot bigger, and of course, with more money in a professional sport, it becomes more of a business, and maybe the fighters also take a different attitude about their opponents and the sport. But in the old days, guys, Niall and Johnny, it was a glorified and a glorious time that the guys felt a sense of camaraderie with each other. And they partied afterwards at our post-fight parties in a way that I remember being memorable. Everyone knew they were doing something special together. We all knew that we were blessed.
I'm sure you joined in those parties as well, Art. I know you like to have a night out there in Las Vegas the odd time, and you're obviously honored in 2018 into the UFC Hall of Fame. Just, you know, we're under a little bit of time here. I could talk to you for hours about the UFC and the history of the UFC. What are some of your favorite moments from your time in the UFC? You must have something that stands out in your mind.
I think the night that Hoist beat Dan Severn was a special time. UFC 4 in Tulsa. I had seen Hoist run out of gas in UFC 3, and we had talked about bringing Hickson in, wanted $1 million, which we couldn't pay him at the time. So seeing Hoist come back and beat Dan Severn with the triangle, and I remember Hoist that night, the feeling that he had of triumph, because Hickson wasn't in his corner for that one. He was alone. He was on his own. He became the champion and the man that he is today. that night, in my humble opinion. That was a high moment for me.
On the low, but getting...
There were so many. I think the first Ultimate, where Dan Severn prevailed, yeah. And the second Ultimate, where Don Fry beat Tank Abbott in the end with a submission. Great moments, you know. So many, but, you know, those early UFCs were glorious. They were magic.
And also, as well, you know, there's obviously a low for you as well. Was that getting out of the sport and having to be, you know, forced out of the UFC at the time?
I think that, as I said earlier, I think that was not a happy ending. But, you know, I had a great ride, and I have no regrets. Years later, I talk about the fact I was driving in a convertible down Hollywood Boulevard, and I look up at a stoplight, and there's this big billboard with Chuck Liddell and Randy Couture on it. I brought Randy in, UFC 13, one of the 8 or 9 fighters that I booked who are in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, I looked at that big billboard. I thought to myself, you know, I'm kind of like a divorced father, and I'm looking to see his kid now is on his own. After the divorce, but my kid is doing well.
Yeah.
The UFC grew up and conquered the world. Many people work in life to do something that leave a mark after they're gone. Long after I'm gone, UFC and MMA will still be here.
Phenomenal words, and I want to sort of end it on that one. Your UFC Hall of Fame speech as well. For me, you said that. You said, you know, the UFC is for everyone, effectively.
Absolutely. And I said that night that, in effect, I've been credited with being the creator and co-founder of the UFC. But the UFC created me. It created Hoist. It created Ronda. It created Conor McGregor. It created all of us fans. And wherever I go now in the world, I have 5,000 Facebook friends. Some of them are in Afghanistan or in Iran or in Myanmar or China. I'm fascinated today that there are people who were only 6 years old when the UFC was born that have now become fans and now know who I am. What a feeling that I've had about how this thing has grown and expanded. And look at how big the United Kingdom and Ireland has become when it comes to MMA. And champions like Conor McGregor. It's been a thrill for me to see the proliferation and the growth of this sport worldwide. And I think it's going to be bigger 20 years from today when I'm gone.
Art,
be bigger 20 years.
It's been an absolute honor to have you on the show, obviously celebrating 25 years of the UFC. I do appreciate the time, and I'm looking forward to having maybe a more in-depth chat soon on our new combat sports show, Off the Brawl.
I'm looking forward at some point, Connor, that we can sit down and have a glass of Jameson together.
Thank you very much, Art. Do appreciate the time.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you, Niall. My pleasure.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.